Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Welcome to another episode of the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Today's guest is Robin Kerner of Blue Republican and Watching America and other things. Hi, Robin.
Hi, how are you doing, Michael?
Good. You're back home in the UK visiting right now, but you live in America, right?
That's right, yes. Visiting family. I'm in the beautiful West Country of England.
You, near what city?
Well, it's really the counties.
Yeah.
That you need to know, Devon and Cornwall.
You know, my middle name is Wareham, which is my mother's maiden name, and it's a town in England.
It is. Actually, it was close to where I was brought up, and actually we pronounce it Wareham.
Not Wareham?
Not Wareham. No,
good to know. Good to know how to pronounce my name. Say it again.
There you go. Wareham.
Wareham. Wear them out. Yeah. I wear them out.
That's right. It's exactly like that.
And my last name is Dean, which is a forest of Dean in England. But my last name was actually Irish. It was from O'Dean, and they changed it at Ellis Island. So I'm English and Irish. So I'm battling in my own brain all the time, I guess.
Wait, battling why? Because you know that the English and the Irish, it's really not as bad as everybody makes out.
I know. Although I've been to Northern Ireland, and I've seen IRA graffiti there, and then like other graffiti crossing it out, and then other graffiti crossing that out.
Yeah.
But you know, you sound more British when you're in Britain.
I do.
You do.
That is true. I think I'm one of those people that's easily affected by my surroundings when it comes to accents and such like. And also, because I'm in the West Country, the accents are quite strong and earthy here. And it's if you go into the really kind of rural areas in the old towns, it's almost a dialect.
You ever seen the movie Brimstone and Treacle?
No, but I do like the title.
It's a really sinister movie with Sting, of all people, playing a con man, and your accent sounds very similar to his accent in that movie. You're a con man, you're completely the opposite, but it's reminding me of Sting in one of my favorite movies, Brimstone and Treacle.
I will look out for that now.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's sort of a variation on Sleeping Beauty, but he has sex with the woman in the coma and it wakes her up instead of kissing.
Now, what kind of movie is this?
It's great. It's a great movie. It's got Denham Elliott in it.
I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, on to real stuff. So give a brief description for our audience of, and the audience of this podcast is a little more varied than Freedom Fiends, where Nima interviewed you. A lot of the people that listen are anarcho-capitalists or libertarians, but about 10 or 20% of them are people that just like my old books on how to make films and don't really have a political connection yet, and probably might even be looking for one. So talk a little bit about Blue Republican and your other project, Watching America.
Sure. Well, Blue Republican is a movement of independents and Democrats who are registering Republican at least for 1 year to help ensure that Ron Paul gets the GOP nomination for the presidency. More broadly, there's kind of a political philosophy associated with Blue Republican, which is the idea that the major issues that are facing the US right now, that the problems that we're facing, are not born just of the Democrats or of the Republicans, but by the actions of both together, and especially all those things that they tacitly agree upon. So, for example, the idea that the Bill of Rights is just an inconvenience to politicians, that's something that Republicans and Democrats agree upon. Preference for crony corporatism, from which many of our federal politicians directly gain, that's something that they agree upon. And the preference for interventionist militaristic solving of problems, in quotes, something else that they tend to agree upon. So the Blue Republicans are saying, look, this partisan thing has to stop. They're kind of post-partisans, and they see Ron Paul as best transcending the current donkey-elephant game that is dictating our politics
today. Is your goal to get Ron Paul the nomination, to get Ron Paul elected, or to get Obama to change his policies, or something else?
My goal is very clearly to get Ron Paul elected.
You think that's going to happen? I hate to ask that, but do you think that's
going to
happen?
Do I think it's going to? I don't think anything's going to happen. Do I think it's possible? Yeah. You know, I mean, my whole shtick is that everybody knows an awful lot less than they think they do, including me. And in that uncertainty, there is always hope. And, you know, I mean, frankly, if we're talking about the Liberty Movement in the last year has already defied expectations and probabilities. And, you know, it can continue to do so. I really don't believe this is in the bag for Romney yet. You know, a week is a long time in politics.
They're talking like it is, though. I mean,
of course they are.
Which, yeah. You know, disgusts me. But, you know, every headline I see now talks about Romney and Obama and doesn't mention anyone else.
Well, you know, here's the thing. If everything were to, let's say, if every trend were to continue linearly, then I guess Romney would be the nominee. But one thing I know for sure about life is that things don't all happen linearly. And, you know, there's enough time for something to give. I mean, you know, and I've written about this in some of the articles, you know, some of my articles too. I mean, there is a lot of creative chaos right now being created in American politics and specifically in the GOP. And I don't think anybody knows how it's all going to play out once the dust has settled. You know, do I expect Ron Paul to be the nominee? No. Do I think it's possible? Yeah.
I agree. I've gone from being a libertarian who is involved in politics to being an anarchist this year. And a lot of it's had to do with Ron Paul's treatment by the media and the GOP. I mean, I don't know if you had time to read it. If you saw it, I sent you an Anarchy Gumbo interview link. I did an interview with a guy here in Wyoming who's a GOP delegate, national delegate, and a long-running Republican. I mean, he didn't just join to help Ron Paul. He's been a Republican his whole life, been involved with politics. And he said that, and Wyoming is the state that had the highest per capita donations to Ron Paul. I mean, he really had a chance here. I mean, there's a lot of square old, you know, farmers here who'd like to see Ron Paul because they're so disgusted with everyone else. I mean, they might be people who'd be horrified by, you know, eliminating marriage licenses and legalizing pot, but they're still backing the guy because they're so disgusted with everyone else. This delegate said he was at the convention and Romney's son stood up and gave a, you know, said these are the people you should vote for in the party. One of the main GOP movers and shakers, you know, the head of the party here, voted twice for Romney. She did it openly in violation of GOP bylaws, somewhere between violation of GOP bylaws and fraud, you know, voter fraud or election fraud. I don't know where it would land in there, but basically she did it so if Ron Paul won, they could demand a recount. I mean, there was some dirty, dirty stuff going on here, and they completely just shut out the Ron Paul delegates. That kind of stuff, just I don't see that as something that can be fixed. It's so entrenched. Do you? Oh,
well, it depends what you mean by fixed. Yeah, I do think there will be a time in the near future, if not immediately, when those kind of shenanigans will not be the determining factor in the outcome of, you know, GOP nomination races. Actually, the fact that this is going on almost proves Ron Paul's success. If Ron Paul was not at the point of being able to actually carry this through normal means, this would not be happening. But, you see, these people are the outgoing people. These kind of actions,
they're old and will die off of natural causes.
Well, I tell you what, I was in the Washington, I went to the caucuses in in Belltown in Seattle, where I live. And I obviously can't participate because I'm not yet an American citizen.
But, I love that you can't participate yet, but you're this involved with politics and influencing other people.
Yeah.
Do you take any criticism for that? Because I think it's great, actually.
I think there were two highly abusive comments under the YouTube video that I voiced about how actually to, you know, get involved in the caucuses and the primaries vote for Ron Paul.
Did they call you a carpetbagger?
I can't remember what they said. I just kind of remember there were a couple of abusive comments. You know, who the hell does this?
I got called a carpetbagger. You know that term?
Yeah, I've heard
that. When I moved from California to Wyoming 3 years ago and was involved in politics there for a while, you know, the carpetbagger was a derogatory term for people from the North who came down and got involved in the politics and Reconstruction in the South after the war. Yeah, I got called a carpetbagger.
Although I have to say, I think I'm quite well received.
Yeah,
I don't, you know, and I joke that because I can't vote, I have to put in all this work to make sure that everybody else votes right for me so that I don't have to head back to England permanently. You know, I want to stay in the States.
Well, I mean, I kind of look at England as about 10 years ahead of the tyranny of America and, you know, everything that's happening here, already happening there. Although there's things happening here that wouldn't happen there. I mean, when I see, you know, 95% of the senators and congressmen in America voting for something like NDAA, and, you know, wanting to vote to regulate the internet and voting for the Patriot Act. I mean, it just seems like the Bill of Rights is out the window. You know, I've been looking at North Korea lately as an extreme example, cautionary example. And North Korea has a constitution that guarantees freedom of speech, if you can believe that. I mean, this is just indicative to me of not anything about North Korea, but just worldwide, how much pieces of paper with laws written on them are ignored. Yes. You know, they have freedom of speech there, literally. But if we were in North Korea, not only if we're in North Korea doing this podcast, soldiers would come in and take us away and probably disappear our whole family and shoot us and then bill our remaining relatives for the bullets. Not only that, most people in North Korea don't know the internet exists. You know, you have to apply and get a permit to get a telephone in your home there. People couldn't afford a computer there. The only people that are on the internet are, you know, high-level party members. And they do have one internet cafe in the country, and it's a closed intranet that's, you know, I looked at it, there's an English version, and it's all, you should check that out for your translation site. I'll send you the link for it. I mean, it's like every headline is like, you know, Kim Jong-un is wonderful. Kim Jong-un gives toys to children. You know, it's all about how great their glorious leader is. And then the other articles are about how horrible America is and how horrible South Korea, right. Korea is.
Yeah, I think I was certainly finding those articles. There's one website that I know that the North Koreans pump all that stuff out on, and I know watching America, we do scan it occasionally.
Okay.
But yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. It's interesting because whilst I think obviously institutionally and mostly because of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, political freedom in the US is you know, arguably the greatest in the world. I mean, in terms of the standards that have been set and the ideals that have been set, the cultural freedom is greater in England, I think. And I find it interesting, and I haven't quite.
What do you mean by cultural freedom? That you can wear a dress while imitating a politician on TV or what?
There is much. Yeah, there's much, much less respect for authority in the UK than there is in the US.
Yeah, here they say, you know, you have to respect the president. I disagree with him, but no matter what, right or wrong, you have to back the president. That doesn't happen in England with the prime minister or the queen?
But no, absolutely not. In fact, as soon as you gain power in England, you immediately become disrespected per se. Authority is something of which the Brits naturally are skeptical. We're naturally skeptical of anyone that would even want to have power. So I actually have much less fear of, you know, big government coming onto the streets with, you know, with guns and tanks and, you know, putting us all in black on rounding us up and sending us off to black sites. That would be much harder to do in Britain than it would be in the US. And the reason is because if it was tried in England, people would just say, who the hell do you think you are? But it wouldn't be out of any political or philosophical purity or love of liberty. It would just be out of a basic cynicism that you know, nobody gets to do that. We just don't take you that seriously, and therefore we don't take your decisions that seriously. That's the view that society has of power in the UK. So I think it's actually harder to be a leader in the UK. It's much harder to get anything done in some ways.
I heard a I heard a contrary opinion to that. It was a writer named Boston Tea Party, which is a great libertarian pseudonym, writing about how with no fight, Britons gave up their guns when they were outlawed, you know, 10 years ago or so. I mean, he said, yeah.
No, but you see, this is the difference, right? Britons don't see, we have a different history here. Britons don't identify guns with the protection of one's own freedom against the monopoly of force. They don't have that sense of political.
They have it here because they were used to shoot the British and get them away.
No, absolutely. And similarly, just as the Brits, you know, happily, you know, the thing is, they didn't think they were giving up anything of value then. It's not that they thought they were giving it up a value, something of value, and they didn't fight. They didn't think it was worth fighting for. Similarly, on the 1st of December 2009, the Lisbon Treaty, otherwise known as the European Constitution, was imposed on 27 European nations, most of whose citizens didn't want it. And nobody, you know, 27 sovereign nations were dissolved on that day. Nobody even marched in the street. They didn't realize what they were losing. There's an ignorance and there's an apathy. But that's, you know, and that's kind of why I guess I'm in the United States. But it doesn't change the fact that I think it would be easier to impose a tyranny by force on Americans than on Brits, because Brits are extremely non-compliant. Once they think that something is important is being done to them, so the standards are different. I think there's much more political ignorance in Europe. Actually, people don't realize in Europe, including in Britain, what we're really playing for when we're doing politics, that we are playing for liberty versus tyranny.
But I think another issue that would make it easier to impose something in England is that more people are dependent on the government, and they're trying to do that here, but socially and economically.
Yes. And it's a disaster. I mean, you know, I write occasionally about the dangers of the welfare state, and specifically how, you know, progressive means, generally statist, centralized means, have not even delivered on the liberal principles that supposedly underlied these big progressive programs.
No, I mean, the recent London riots prove that the cradle to the grave ain't working, I think.
It does not. I mean, and I see Britain as being further down the road that America is racing down. And it scares me. I mean, it really repels me from coming back to the country of my birth to live.
Who's that MP that they call the Ron Paul of England?
Probably Dan Hannan, or it might be Nigel Farage.
Yeah, they got a couple of them there, don't they? They just rail against the nanny state in Parliament.
The two best British MPs they're not MPs, they're members of the European Parliament, so they're MEPs, are Nigel Farage and Daniel Hannan. And I would tell any of your listeners to Google them, especially Daniel Hannan. He writes beautifully, apart from being, you know, very, very politically smart.
Cool. So talk a little about your other website, Watching America.
Yeah, so Watching America, it's been going for about 7 or 8 years, and what we do is we find and translate foreign opinion pieces and news pieces about the United States from all over the world. So if you actually want to find out, let's say, what the Iraqis are saying to each other in Arabic about U.S. foreign policy, you go to watchingamerica.com and you will find articles that were written by Iraqis in Arabic, translated into English, so that you know Americans can see how they're being perceived. And we don't editorialize. My own politics do not appear anywhere on that site. So it's not pro-American, anti-American, left-wing, right-wing, or anything in between. We're just trying to fairly represent global news and views about the U.S.
It sounds like a very useful service, and it's all done voluntarily, right? You have an army of volunteers that speak different languages.
It really is an army. It's about 400 volunteers, and about 36 of them are the editorial team who make sure that we're, you know, finding all the articles we need to translate, and that all the translators are, you know, coming through and doing enough articles for us. And then they check the quality of the English just to make sure that the translations are accurate. And then all the rest are the translators. And yeah, they're from all over the world. We have all the big languages covered. And we update the site frequently every day.
Do you ever check when a non-US site has a native language version and also like a link you can click on to get an English version of it? Do you ever check that against itself?
Yeah. You know, most translations are accurate, and in most cases, if a publication runs its own English language version of another language article, it's fine, and we just link to the English. But in some cases, the English version is of a different flavor from the
I'd be really curious about the North Korean site, because they do have it in Korean and English. Although I can't imagine how much more scathing the Korean version could be, because the English version is pretty scathing.
Yes, no, I don't think they really moderate it for English language consumers, as it were.
Interesting thing about North Korea is it has 99% literacy and there's no income tax. And I'm not stating it as a, hey, let's all move there. It pretty much has the worst record in the world for human rights violations. But it's interesting. I mean, I think the reason that they have total literacy is because the state demands it. The state needs everyone literate to do their bidding. The no income tax thing is just because they're just stealing everything else. They just own everything. They own the factories everyone works in. They own everything.
Yeah. Well, there's no income tax because there's no private property.
Yeah.
So you could say the income tax is 100%.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I believe the literary. I don't believe the literary thing.
I know it'd be hard. I mean, that's not a place that it'd be easy to independently third party, make sure. That would be pretty low. You know, it's so hard to get someone in there. They'd be busy checking other things like nukes. Literacy would be pretty low on the totem pole of things to check.
Yeah.
There's a really good documentary from, do you know Vice magazine?
No, I don't think so.
They're kind of a tongue-in-cheek hipster New York magazine, but they've actually been making documentaries that are amazing. And there's one where they kind of sneak into North Korea, but once they're there, they're given the tour as journalists, and it's really, really, it's mind blowing. I mean, they were shuffled into this stadium and shown this presentation by 110,000 performers that looked kind of like, you know, the Beijing Olympics opening, but you know, the 7 people from Vice magazine were the only audience.
I think I've seen this. I think, and if it's the documentary that I'm thinking of, that is at the end of the documentary.
Yeah,
and the gentleman says, you know, the only reason the North Koreans allow tourists in is so they can show them this.
Yeah. They give them a very moderated tour. I mean, they can't go anywhere without a handler, and the handlers, you know, one of the places they take them is this library that has, English and European books, and then they have a listening library with headphone stations with Western rock and roll music, and they present it as if, oh, this is where the people come in and listen to music, and it's not. The whole room is empty. It's got 200 listening stations that are empty. It's so, you know, party members and mainly the handlers who take tourists, you know, and journalists around know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've seen that. No, it's fascinating. It's terrifying and fascinating.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So what can people in America and the UK and Europe what can we do to keep our country from progressively sliding to a North Korea style dictatorship?
Well, the first thing is educate yourself. And the second thing is to demand your rights, because of course the only rights you have are the ones that you fight for. And I say, you know, I don't advocate violence, but it's probably time to take to the streets.
Really? Robin's the one who says that. That's interesting to me. That's very interesting to me, because I kind of came from a mindset like that. And I ended up listening to this guy named Ben Stone, Bad Quaker podcast. You ever listen to that?
No, this one's new for me.
He's completely talked me into pacifism. I mean, you know, if someone mugs me on the street, I'm not going to curl up in the ball and I carry a gun and I'm going to defend myself. But, you know, I'm almost a pacifist, and I am, you know, I'm literally in a room full of loaded assault weapons right now. But I have become the most peace loving, like violence is not the answer, education is the answer guy. And I've always thought of you, this is not an insult, it's a fact. I talk to all different kinds of people, but I've always thought of you as kind of a theorist, which to me means someone who is brilliantly educated and talks a wonderful talk about it, but would never, I don't know, man. I don't mean to call you a theorist. I'm just like, I'm shocked that you're saying it's time to take to the streets with violence.
No, I said I wouldn't advocate violence.
Okay, what'd you say? Oh, take to the streets to march?
I wouldn't advocate violence, but I think it's time, you know, it's probably time to take to the streets.
I'm sorry, I said corrected.
Yeah, yeah. That's an important correction, isn't it?
It certainly is.
I was actually asked in an interview a while ago, actually not long ago, it was with the Daily Bell just a week or two ago, if there's such a thing as a good war. And I gave a one word answer, which was yes. I would say there may be a time when violence is the only way to go, but I'm not sure that we ever get to violence having tried everything else that should have first been tried. And if we had that, you know, those peaceful means wouldn't have worked.
See, I think I think the possibility of an armed revolution in America is completely past as of 2 or 3 years ago, basically when drones got to the point where they can do what they do now.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't care if we have assault rifles anymore. Right. If you started a militia, they'd just friggin' drone you, you know?
Oh, yeah, but, you know... Well, let's go back a step. Let's go back to the taking to the streets, because, you know, if you had simultaneous marches of, let's just say, the size that we saw against the Iraq war in pretty much every other capital city in the developed world, right, when Bush was preparing for Iraq War II, if you had those sized demonstrations, peaceful marches, in the main cities of America, the powers that be wouldn't know what to do with themselves.
Well, where are the people marching in the street against war that were so vocal under Bush? Those same people are going door to door right now to try to get Obama, you know, the warmonger Obama, yeah, reelected.
Tell me about it. I wrote about this in an article on the Huffington Post called There Is No Left Left.
You deal with them 24/7. You know, I'm 48. I grew up in the 60s in the Vietnam War, and that was the last time I really saw anger against the government like we have now. But the anger against the government now is coming from everyone, not just the college students and the young and the leftists. I mean, the leftists are pretty complacent right now. I think everybody's mad right now at something.
Well, if they're mad, they're not mad enough, because, you know, all the while we don't take to the streets and show that, you know, and protest, you know, that the NDAA does constitute a takedown of the Bill of Rights, that the Patriot Act does constitute a takedown of the Bill of Rights, and that we value our Bill of Rights. You know, if we're not going to take to the streets for that, you know, I don't know what we are going to take to the streets for. So, the politicians get away with what they get away with because we let them. And as I say, that doesn't mean violence. It just means shocking them It just means showing them something they haven't seen before and don't know how to deal with. And a million people marching through Los Angeles or Chicago or New York, you know, I don't think that would be disproportionate to the abuses that are being meted out on this nation right now.
You sound almost like an anarchist, like an anarcho-capitalist to me. Yet you're
I
in.
Don't f-
go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Go on, Michael. Finish your
Yet thing. You're involved in politics.
Yeah, okay. I don't feel like an anarcho-capitalist because it seems to me that the anarcho-capitalist position, which I'm not here disagreeing with, by the way, or agreeing with, is quite a purist one. And I see politics as a very kind of purist discipline. I was trained in physics and philosophy. They are purist disciplines. Practical politics isn't purist because, for example, when we vote for Ron Paul and we get him elected, we don't wake up in Ron Paul's libertarian utopia, whatever that may mean. You know, so Ron Paul's libertarian utopia remains a hypothetical. What starts happening is we move in a direction, and that direction would be away from tyranny towards civil rights, away from militarism towards peace. And yeah, we're so far away from our civil rights and away from peaceful foreign policy that basically, if you're a principled liberal or a principled conservative or a principled constitutionalist or libertarian or any of these things, you want to move in the other direction. You want to move towards civil rights and peace and all these things. So I don't think I need a position on anarchism. All I need to do is observe what's wrong with where we are and know the direction we need to move in. And that, you know, that's how I feel. I'm with Ron Paul on something that he says quite often, which is that people ask him, well, what should I do? And he says, do whatever feels right to you. And for some people, that is expounding a pure, quite philosophical political position, let's say, for example, anarchism, which seems to be so far from where we are that the value really is in the theoretical statement because the stating of it ain't going to make it so.
I'm a theorist, but you know, my idea is kind of like when you're negotiating with somebody, you ask for a lot more than you think you're going to get. So I guess an anarchist is asking for no government and may end up with a tiny bit of government.
And of course, what they're doing is valuable because you stake out the direction by staking out the destination.
I will say this, Nima and I, in all the media that we do, we are straight up anarchists, and we do not like people who are involved in politics in any way. There are two people who are involved in politics in any way that we like and quote and reference frequently. They are Ron Paul and Robin Kerner. So,
well,
there.
That's a great to pick.
Yeah.
All I would say is, and I must say, I'm very honored by to be in a group of two wherein one is Ron Paul. So that's humbling. No, but I would say, look, you know, there is a reason what you do is valuable, but there is a reason why you may reference me or Ron Paul. And that's because it's not either or. You know, here's something to live by. Nearly all dichotomies are false. Nearly every either or is in reality a both and. We need people staking out that pure destination, and then we need people who are actually engaging to help, you know, move us there. We're all most effective where we feel the passion and where we see with clarity. And, you know, I look at things as they are politically, and I think that I can do a lot of good by telling them as they are truthfully. And using a language that resonates with people, that kind of gets through people's filters, seems to be what I'm good at. That's a different project than, say, arguing theoretically for anarchism and its advantages. Both valuable, both different.
I think Ron Paul has created 10 million anarchists. I really do.
Well then good for him, because they might balance out the rampant social democrats that we have that have been pulling this country down, in the gutter towards, well, where Europe has been sitting for a while.
I was a Democrat 5 years ago. I mean, I voted for Nancy Pelosi once in my life in California.
Wow.
Yeah. So I feel I'm making amends for I'm making amends with a lot of what I do. I think my wife really understands that either or is both and better than I do, because she often answers this or that questions with yes. Like, an example, last night she's watching Game of Thrones and I walked in and I hate that stuff. I'm like, bleh. And I walked in and she's watching it and there's some, you know, naked woman sitting on the lap of some Visigoth. And I said, is that a prostitute or a slave? And she said, yes. But, you know, she frequently answers political questions like that too. So I need to listen to her more, maybe.
She sounds good. Especially if she's, you know, looking at things that involve prostitutes and slaves. But anyway, that's a, especially when they're one and the same. No, definitely. I mean, everybody should play to their strengths. And as long as we all want to go in the same direction, it doesn't really matter if somebody wants to go a bit further than somebody else. Because right now, we are not anywhere near to where any one of us wants to be. So let's all pull in the same direction.
And getting worse quicker. I mean, the first couple of years of Obama, about once a week, I'd see a news item that would make me go, ugh. You know, and if I'd been paying attention politically during Bush, the same thing would have happened, but I wasn't really politically aware.
Sure.
I basically became a libertarian 4 weeks ago last Friday, which was watching the libertarian convention on TV when they had Mary Ruart up against Bob Barr, and they picked Bob Barr, who is anything but a libertarian, and everyone was upset. And I was like, why are they upset? And I went and researched it. But, you know, basically since New Year's Eve this year, so many things have been passed with full cooperation of Congress that have made me just go, you've got to be kidding me. That I just feel like there was somebody on anti-war radio said it really well. They said that the planes of 9/11 knocked the Earth off its axis into bizarro world.
Yeah, it does feel like that. I mean, you know, one thing that I, you know, a theme that I kind of discuss a lot in my writing is that we're living in an age, certainly a decade, of the politics of fear. And if you want to look at the underlying motivation of all the most egregious passing of laws that, you know, we've had in the last decade, you know, whether that's the NDAA or Patriot Act, or, you know, a lot of these executive orders, a lot of the internet regulation, all this kind of thing, it's all about being scared of what happens if we don't do it. Right. So, you know, we're bailing out the banks because we're terrified of what happens if we don't. You know, we will take away your Fourth Amendment rights because we're terrified of what happens if we don't. And when I say we, actually, America, I don't think the American people are anymore. It's now really just the elites. And this is why, I think there is value in people taking to the streets, which really is a very immediate and practical engagement.
They outlaw that too. There's a law against that now. Secret Service is, they can arrest you whether you know they're there or not.
Right. So that's why we have to do it now, because, you want to resist the law at the beginning of the period in which you have to, rather than at the end.
I mean, I kind of look at this politics of fear. Nima has a really good word for it. It's a reference to the movie Terminator 2. Do you know that movie?
I've not watched it.
Okay. Well, at the end, the evil robot is thrown into a vat of molten steel and is thrashing as it's dying. And he says that the politics of fear are the T-1000, the T-2000 thrashing in the molten steel. It's the death throes. It's like they can't get things done just by saying, well, we're politicians and you elected us and we need to do this. Now they have to say, you know, your children are going to get raped in the streets by bands of marauders if we don't steal a bunch of money and print it and give it to the banks.
Right. And this is, I mean, I think he's right in that, you know, I write about the paradigm shift. And one way you know a paradigm is about to collapse is that the attempts to keep it going become increasingly absurd and increasingly dogmatic and increasingly oppressive. We're seeing all of those things. So, you know, these very evils should in some way be cause for hope. And, you know, if you guys, let's say, as kind of pure anarchists out there saying this is the way we should make the world once the collapse has happened, you need people like me to try and make sure the collapse happens as soon and quickly as possible, with, you know, as little harm done to as few people as possible.
I don't really have a plan for rebuilding it. And I don't even really have a plan for making it fall. All I am absolutely sure of is that it is immoral as it stands. I mean, there's a, do you ever listen to Stefan Molyneux?
No.
He has a really good, he's a British guy that lives in Canada, and he's got a very popular podcast and radio show. He says it really succinctly. I can't come up with something better than this, of when people say, well, if we lived in a libertarian paradise, you know, who would take care of the roads and who would take care of the starving grandmothers? And his answer is, that's like someone in 1850s America saying, well, I'd like to free the slaves, but who would pick the cotton? You know, you free the slaves because it's the moral thing to do. And then the cotton yes. figures out a way to get picked. The cotton still got picked after slavery, you know?
Yeah. 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 I like that.
He's a good one. You should check him out. Mm.
Yeah, I will. I will.
Wow. A lull between us? That's impossible.
Over to you.
If I've seemed like I've been interrupting you, it's more just you really excite me and I have a lot to say about it too. I don't mean to keep stepping on you, but statistically the chances of a 10 second lull was pretty low. I was pretty amazed by that.
That wasn't 10 seconds. It just felt longer than it was because it's the first one in half an hour.
It was 2 seconds.
Yeah, it was yeah. about two. it's all good. So, chance to catch breath.
So what are you doing in England? Seeing family?
I am seeing family. Yes.
Cool.
It's very good. And this is a glorious time of year to be here.
Yeah. I've been there then. I've been there now. Then it's nice.
Yeah, no, it's good.
What is your what does your family think of what you do?
What do they think of? I think they're kind of delighted. I think you know, I think my dad has been wondering, you know, what am I gonna do of any use? He's been wondering that for a few
years. Well, don't
you
have a degree from Oxford?
I've never heard of Oxford, but I do have 3 degrees from Cambridge.
There you go. You've never heard of Oxford?
I'm being tongue-in-cheek oh. because obviously if I'm from Cambridge, I have to say
it's
things
it's the
like
rivals. It's the rivals. Okay. So yeah, you have 3 degrees from Cambridge. You know, a lot of parents would say, why aren't you in a high-level position in a multinational conglomerate by now or teaching at a college?
Right.
At university.
Yeah, no, they would. And well, my mother's always been happy as long as I've been happy. I did try corporate consulting for a couple of years, corporate strategy, and I got quite a lot out of it, but it was quite clear that that lifestyle wasn't for me. You know, I'm just not very good at being told what to do and how to think and how to approach things.
Anarchist.
Well, yeah, or maybe just my own person, you know. Especially, you know, and I guess this is becoming evident from my writing. I will look at a big system and I will see through it and I will see what's going wrong, what's being done badly, what could be done better. And what if you kind of, if you operate that way as I do, to be told to carry on, you know, to be a part of this system in this way that isn't very efficient or effective, to kind of just go along. Yeah, that doesn't work for me. So, no, I'm more of an entrepreneur by spirit, really.
Do you ever watch the British comedy called Peep Show?
I'm actually one of the two main characters in that, David Mitchell, was at my college in my year at Cambridge. so I know him quite well.
Is he the square guy or the hip guy? Which does he play? Guy. He plays the square guy. I love the square guy. Yeah. I kind of love the hip guy too. I'm kind of a cross. I love that show because I kind of see myself as both of those guys.
Yeah, well, that's why it works, I guess. There's a bit of both in every of those guys of us, right? Yeah.
So I have a theory, and not to try to bring everyone into my anarchist camp and say everyone's an anarchist and just doesn't know it. I actually think, based on a few things Ron Paul said, at some of the Republican debates that he has become an anarchist and will come out as that when he's done with politics, because he's said a few things about the immorality of government, and he's not talking about
sure.
this government. He's talking about government, period.
Sure. I think you can talk about that without claiming, as it were, the mantle of an anarchist.
He claims the mantle of a constitutionalist, which
right.
I believe he was for decades. And I think the reason he got into politics is all he says is if you are going to be in politics, you should follow the Constitution. You know, his answer to to going after bin Laden was, no, we don't need to invade these countries. We should issue letters of marque, which made sense to me, but it's a really strange, if there's anything in the Constitution that probably is an anachronism, it's letters of marque. I mean, that goes back to like British UK official Queen sanctioned piracy. Although one could argue that, you know, Blackwater probably has letters of marque. They're just not called that. But, go on.
Yeah, but look, I would say, you know, again, if you are going to have the effect you want to have, if you want to take down part of a system or a system of its entirety, always the best place to be is inside it. I actually find it strange that people that would like to see radically less government or indeed no government don't want to fill government. I mean, just as a practical matter.
I did. That's when I was 3 years ago when I was involved in politics in Wyoming and people were calling me a carpetbagger for it. I was trying to get liberty-minded, small-minded constitutionalists to replace the ranchislators that are running this town and, you know, do things like say, oh, we need to outlaw we need to outlaw Sharia when, you know, no such thing exists in this state. And they do things like, increasing passing a bill that says medical marijuana cards will not be honored from other states when it's already the law that they're not honored here. I mean, that's the kind of politicians we have here.
Oh yeah. All of that kind of declarative politics.
Yeah.
Which really only ever declares the insecurity of the people trying to promote one law or another. Absolutely. Anyway, but this is why, you know, I want people like Ron Paul, you know, like you, in there, slowing this stuff up and telling the truth about it. Because, you know, the thing is, if you have an official platform, a mainstream platform, it does help you get ideas out.
That is the most valuable thing Ron Paul has done. I think of his 30-year political career, the biggest coup he had was this year, one night when it's not as big as everything else he's done, but the biggest thing he's done, and it's one of the most important things he's done, was he got about 20 minutes on Fox and MSNBC talking after one of the primaries. I mean, he was talking about Austrian economics and going back to the gold standard. And you don't hear that on mainstream TV in prime time, but he got 20 minutes of it on both two of the three news channels.
Yeah. And you are beginning to hear these things on prime time. And if you're not hearing it now, you will be very soon, as long as the liberty movement keeps true to itself. I mean, his persistence, his using of that platform on the few occasions he's been given it, is having a disproportionate impact, because human beings resonate with the truth. There's something about the truth which is, you know, always self-evident, right? You know, it's like obscenity. You know it when you see it. That's truth is like obscenity. Do you know what I mean?
And yeah,
it's like get out there and speak with credibility. See, it's all about having the credibility. It's all about being able to speak in a way that doesn't cause the person listening to you to immediately put up their walls because they've stuck you in a box with a label on it and decided you have nothing to say to them because then, you know, you and he are not on the same team. You know, you're not made of the same stuff.
Awesome.
And that's why I think my writing at the HuffPo has worked, because I go to great lengths to understand where I think my reader is, rather than make sure they understand me.
Cool.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
Okay, we're rolling. So let's talk about the songbirds of England. I'm looking at a bunch of pigeons out my window. I guess some people call them doves, but they are the same species as pigeons. So,
right. There's a lot of pigeons and doves that pass the window that I've been sitting at for most of the time I've been down here in Cornwall. A lot of chaffinches and robins and a few swallows, even the occasional buzzard.
Really?
Yeah.
Buzzards. Don't have them in town here. Have to go out in the sticks for that.
Right. Yeah, well, it's quite rural down here in the West Country.
So can people, you know, the American view of England is that it's complete socialism, but there are rich people there. There are people who can have private property there. They're heavily taxed. But how does that work? And what about the haves and the have-nots there compared to the U.S.?
Private property is well protected, except for in the big and important area of the tax system. Taxes are higher in the UK than in the US. One thing that I find somewhat appalling is that the last Labour government put the top rate of income tax up to 50%, and the current government has said that it would drop it to 45. And people of my generation, who I would otherwise deem quite intelligent, think that this proves that the government is a government of rich people for rich people and some kind of outrage.
Well, now, 50%, that's not even all the taxes they're paying. I mean, they're still paying like sales tax, VAT tax, property tax, etc.
That's what I was going to get to.
That's so probably 90% total or 80% of everything.
It's crazy. I mean, we have a 20% value added tax here on everything you buy, VAT, 20% sales tax.
Now, right? Is that at every point of sale? Like, does the merchant pay that when they buy it wholesale also?
Yeah. Yeah, I believe it is. Yeah.
Every time there's a value added by someone's reselling
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, companies register for VAT, you know, so they work out how much they're paying and how much they're collecting. And it's all, yeah, all a big thing. But the biggest problem I see in this area for Britain is an absolute out of control welfare state. It's completely terrifying.
It's still not working. I mean, you look at the London riots.
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, and that's kind of interesting because, you know, you can talk on the one hand about the entitlement mentality that it generates, and it truly does, and I can talk about that for hours. But on the other hand, there's a deep resentment building, I think, because there are people who just have been brought up better than to expect everybody else to pay for them. And they often work very, very hard and have no higher standard of living than entire families who are on government welfare. Now, to give you a specific kind of data point regarding how bad this is, the current government had huge political difficulty in passing a law that said no more than the cap on welfare will be the average salary of a working family. Ugh. Now, can you imagine that there can even be so many welfare payments in society that you could even be close to having to make that law?
Yeah, so wait, the average welfare check would be what a working for one person would be what a working family makes.
So that the max, what they wanted to say was that the maximum welfare check for a family would be the average family working family's income.
Why work? Why work?
Exactly. Exactly why work. And, you know, so you have on the one hand an entitlement class. On the other hand, you have, you know, an honest working class that where there's building resentment. I mean, the government will now buy you a car if you are deemed to be immobile and so unable to get to work. There are people who have children repeatedly so that their child benefit never stops.
Well, that happens here too, but the benefits aren't quite as high.
Yeah, the benefits aren't quite as high, yeah, and it's harder to get them. It's very easy to get them here. Now, you've got a large number of households in the UK, about 10%, where no child in the house has ever seen a parent work. Ever seen a parent work. So we have now hardwired the disconnect between work and having things and surviving and making one's way. Now, that is obviously destructive of society. And interestingly, you know, it's the left that have been concerned about society as opposed to just a collection of individuals that have managed to destroy it with this system. And the worst thing about the system, of course, is that you've destroyed all space for compassion among the citizens, because you've got a big impersonal state taking by force from some, giving to others, so that those who receive have no sense, no perception of the impact on those who are funding them.
Did you used to be a liberal?
Yeah, I mean, if you needed to give me a label, yes, that would be the closest label.
Which probably makes it easier for you to talk to people. I used to be a Democrat, and my analogy for it is kind of like how in AA, a recovering alcoholic can help an alcoholic who's still drinking stop drinking better than someone with a degree in alcoholism or addictionology. You know, someone who's been there can talk to those people.
No, that's exactly it. And that's definitely why the Huffington Post was the right platform for me, and I'm able to use it.
Are you a paid writer there, or you just have a blog that's very popular there?
Yeah, they just one day gave me a login and password and said, yeah, go write stuff if you want. I mean, that was it.
I mean, your site there is so popular, I thought you were one of the staff members.
Well, I'll let you into a secret, Michael. I am spending so much time now promoting liberty without getting paid for any of my time that I'm up against it. I mean, Time Magazine or Vanity Fair or someone has to call me up and say, we'll pay you to write if this is going to continue, because there's only so much I can do for nothing. I wish it were the case that I was a paid writer. Although, you know, I've certainly enjoyed the complete editorial freedom to write what I
want. A lot of movers and shakers have day jobs. I have a day job. My day job is writing, but it's writing technical books on how to use software. You know, that's what I do for a living, and I make a pretty good living at it. I mean, my wife and I own a house, and I make my own hours, but I'd rather not be doing that, but I have to do it. You know, I don't make a living doing Freedom Fiends. We make enough to cover our web hosting, which is massive now. We're getting about 350 gigs a month of downloads. So, you know, that costs $70 a month. But, you know, we make enough to we get Vaporsmiths, which are our electronic cigarettes, and I've quit smoking. So I'm actually saving $500 a month because one of our advertisers pays us in product. So between that, you know, it's pretty much a break even proposition though.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I think I'm just aware now that obviously, you know, the ideas that I'm talking about have drawn a lot of attention. I'm drawing increasing attention, and I see all the potential for really making a difference in the US.
Have you been offered any jobs that you turned down on a moral standpoint?
Well, I haven't sought any jobs.
It seems like you seem like someone that someone from a political action committee would try to hire.
Oh yeah. I mean, I am discovering that I am really quite good at this, you know, so putting together a political message for a particular audience. I've also been in touch with a campaign in New Jersey, a Democrat campaign, interestingly, which my next article will be about. So look out for that in the next few days on the HuffPo and the Daily Poll. I do feel like I've got a knack for it. So, you know, there is the possibility, I think, that I will be able to make a business out of the doing the good of spreading liberty by helping the right people who are engaged in the political process in the US. I would love to do that.
There's a lot of money to go around, but most of it would be for doing things that you probably wouldn't want to do or backing people you wouldn't want to back.
But in that case, no, I wouldn't do that. I mean, I don't think I would ever be that desperate. You know, I could have cashed in my Cambridge degrees, if you like, doing jobs that I didn't believe in, probably for hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars by now. Yeah. And I took a deliberate choice not to do that. I like living authentically. I like being able to tell the truth all the time. My raison d'etre is to, as I see it, tell the truth. That's kind of what I'm about. That's what drives me. I don't need people to agree with me, but I just hate lying in all its forms, whether to others, whether to myself. You know, so
it's hard to make it's hard to make a living if you have integrity. That's what I found, which basically for me has meant doing something on the side that is neutral, that I don't have a value judgment on. You know, there's nothing evil about writing tutorials on using Adobe Premiere, and I'm good at it, and I can do it from home. But you know, that's what I have to do. You know, I used to work in, when I was writing my first novel, this is before I was politically active. You know, I wrote my first novel, which got published, didn't make a lot of money, but got published, and I was doing it while working a 9-to-5 job in an office wearing a suit and tie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what I do too. I have a modest income through, you know, neutral work, have, you know, done that for a while. But I am kind of fortunate. I'm kind of uniquely placed. I'm uniquely placed because I'm an outsider of the country, really. You know, I mean, I'm a Brit, I'm looking from the outside, so I have a certain angle. I think it means that people might be a little more open to me. You know, there's not many people that can say they've actually, you know, added a term to the language, but I think I'm at the point where I think I can say that now.
Blue Republican. Blue Republican. Yeah.
So people are eager to hear from me, I think. And, I don't want to waste that very special opportunity and privilege that I've been given. And so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, if I can make a living out of doing more of that good, then that's got to be the way to go. I'm now kind of thinking about, not just having Blue Republican out there as, if you like, a political philosophy, you know, a post-partisan classical liberal constitutional political philosophy, but also using it as a brand. You know, branding it, you know, selling t-shirts with, you know, witty slogans on or whatever it might be. And I will start asking people who are kind of supporting this effort, you know, liberals and independents who are coming around for Ron Paul, you know, I think to donate to the cause, because I know there's a lot of work that I could do. I mean, I can be a multiplier for liberty.
You know what you could do for a living? Here's an idea. You'd have to learn to do it for yourself first, but it might be easier to start a shop doing it and get a lot of work behind it. Basically, it would be finding people like you and me who have a great idea and have a brand, but don't have time to market it, and marketing it for them. You know, you could be the guy who has the connection with the t-shirt. Like, anybody can put a t-shirt up on Cafe Press, but they look like crap. They're not printed well. It washes out, you know, to actually have some money behind it with a t-shirt press, to do marketing, to do things like that. Do it for other people. You could do it.
But I'm interested in the ideas, right? I'm always an ideas kind of guy. And I am in the lucky position that I've made a brand out of an idea or a set of ideas. So obviously, if I'm going to be pushing any brand, marketing any products, it's going to be something that's going to support those ideas. Although I'm very happy to have those of like mind contribute and benefit from those efforts.
No, but what I'm saying is, even though you're having trouble doing this right now for yourself, it's because you don't have time to do it. I think I just think you could brainstorm, write a white paper, write a business proposal, get some backing, and become the guy who is like a manager or agent for other liberty people to sell their brand. Mm. I think you could do it. Your degrees say you could do it. Think about it.
Oh yeah. There's nothing that I believe I can't do.
And I think, there you go. And I think that the word that you've contributed, the phrase you've contributed to the language, Blue Republican, is a lot more valuable than the word that Nima and I have contributed to the language that a lot of people use now, which is worms, which we say instead of, you know, people say word, meaning you speak the truth. We say worms, which we didn't even make up. My friend David Immergluck, the guitar player in Counting Crows that I used to play in a band called Slish with, made it up about 15 years ago. But we have added that to the language and a lot of people use it now. I think that Blue Republican is Blue Republican's a lot more valuable than worms.
Well, you know, anything that catches the public imagination and is useful has got to be good.
So you married?
No.
How old are you?
I am 37, just turned.
Are you single?
I will leave my private life okay. Out of the interview.
Okay, he's a good-looking guy. So, you know, if anyone out there is interested, I'm looking at his picture on his little Skype icon right now. Good-looking guy. Kind of looks like a younger, better-looking me, if you can picture that.
Oh, there you go. I must be stunningly handsome.
So, going forward, the future of the world. You got 5 minutes.
What do you want me to tell you about?
It's open-ended, man. Where you think it's going to go, where you want it to go. I'll say where I think it's going to go, where I'm afraid it's going to go, okay. Is not a North Korea-style tyranny. I think America, at least, is going to go more towards a Brave New World? What's the other dystopian?
1984.
Yeah, I think it's going to be more Brave New World than 1984. I think we're going to be drugged with Soma, and everyone's going to be fully employed by the government, and it's going to be pleasantness to the point of complacency and dullness and emotional death. Courtesy of the government.
Is that your prediction for the United States or
it's my fear. It's my fear for the United States.
Okay. Yeah. Well, look, you know, there's, as I say, you know, one of the things I love about the US is that there is an activism here. There are enough people who are scared of that future, who are blue Republicans, who are supporting Ron Paul. And that's what gives me hope. You see, the difference between the US and Europe is not that there is any more or less tyranny in the US or Europe than in the other continent. It's that people are getting angrier faster in the US, that there is a growing opposition here, where I think there's a greater complacency in Europe and a greater apathy. Certainly there's a greater political apathy in England, where I am now, than in the US. And, you know, I don't know. As I say, I don't know if we're going to see Americans in the street, but I feel we could be closer to it in the US than in England. Obviously, there are people coming into the streets in these European countries that have been decimated by this huge tyranny that is the European Union. But they've only decided to come to the streets now they're being directly harmed, you know, in their pocketbooks and wallets. They're not for any real grand ideas.
What about Greece, man? Greece recently elected a bunch of Nazis and commies. Like, boy, that worked well historically in the past.
Well, I mean, you know, don't forget also, you've got the European Union actually putting, you know, taking down democratically elected governments, as in Italy.
Well, the U.S. has made a history of that for the past 100 years. I mean, the CIA, that's what they do, or one of the things.
Yeah.
Starting with Mossadegh, yeah, in Iran.
But the way that gets past the American people is by not letting the American people know what's going on. In Italy, all the Italians knew what was going on, but they just sit there and took it.
Well, I think the internet is the game changer. We didn't have that before. We just had the news.
Absolutely. It's hugely important. We wouldn't be seeing this shift in the zeitgeist in the US and the rise of Ron Paul that we're seeing now if it weren't for the internet. No doubt about it. Yeah. So some of these things are very much in our favor, you know, in favor of the liberty movement.
Worms. So I like it. It's a good interview, man. I think that... the next time I want to interview you is November 7th. Do you know why?
November 7th.
Yeah.
Okay.
I want to do another interview. Okay. You know why?
No, tell me.
It's the day after the election.
Oh, yeah. Well, that figures.
I'll mark it on my calendar. Cool, man. It's been great having you on.
It's been a pleasure, Michael. Thank you for your time.
Worms.
Look forward to doing it again.
Worms.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiends show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com.
All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.